Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 140, with guests Matt Anderson from the Sci-Fi Christian Podcast and also Rick Lee James from the Voices in My Head Podcast. So listen up, because we've got a really fun show for you. On this episode, we talk Spider-Man Homecoming and Redeeming Fatherhood.
Did you guys say that the last time... Well, one of the last times you guys were together was for Amazing Spider-Man 2, right?
Amazing Spider-Man 2, yeah. And my exact words on that movie was, I think I liked it, maybe. I wasn't sure. Now I'm pretty sure I don't. I had some time to think about it.
I think I wanted to like it a lot more at the time, and so I was apologetic for it.
Yeah.
Even though I was like, yes, there are some very large gaping problems with this movie, but I like the Andrew Garfield, you know.
Yeah,
I liked him as Peter Parker,
and so. I particularly like Spider-Man, so it's hard for me to like admit I don't like a Spider-Man movie, but I really had, after I watched it a second time after we had talked, I was like, oh, this movie's just bad. I just, you know, I liked Andrew Garfield, but it was a rough movie, and I don't think I've revisited it again since then. I kind of feel opposite of that on this new movie. I can't wait to see it again. I'd love to back, and I haven't yet. But
I was hoping to see it a second time before we recorded, but I wasn't able to see it a second time yet.
Yeah, same here.
Well, actually, so that's very interesting to me that you would even or you guys would even try to find time to see it a second time. I feel like we're all very busy. You know, like Rick, I know you're touring and stuff, and Matt, you and I both are trying to like hold down podcasts while also like holding down family life, you know,
right,
and jobs and things that are not our podcasts. So going to the theater is like a premium for us. And as we mentioned before the show, we have, I think, all enjoyed 2017. I mean, I said this earlier in the year, and I harped on the opposite of this all throughout 2016, that I thought 2016 was a pretty rotten year overall for film. But 2017 has already blown me away multiple times. Like, there's already more movies that would be in my top 10 that have come out this year than almost anything that came out last year. So I feel like there's still plenty of things I need to see. So going to the theater a second time, I'm wondering, when you guys say that, is it because you enjoyed Spider-Man Homecoming so much that you were willing to use some of that precious time to see this movie again because you enjoyed it so much, or that you could just fit it in? Like, what does that tell us?
Well, I think I really enjoyed it, and I do have several problems with the film, but I still, at the same time, I just loved seeing Spider-Man in a very, in a way that reminded me of like a Spidey in the comic book. You know, I like Tom Holland a lot. He's fun to see on the screen, and it feels like it's just a really good time. It's not a deep movie. I think for me, it's more a relaxing type thing. And so I would, if I had time and money, which I don't usually, I would try to go see it again at a matinee or something, just, especially if it's been a stressful week, which there's just a lot going on right now. And I don't always do that with films. A lot of times it's just once and I'm done. But for some reason, I want to see it again. And that's really my, you know, it would be great. If I had a DVD of it, I'd probably put it in tonight and watch it. You know?
Nice.
So
What about you, Matt? Yeah.
Yeah. Just like Rick was saying, I'm a longtime Spider-Man fan. As a kid, I read the comics, and so grew up loving that character. So I think every time I see a Spider-Man movie in the theaters, I leave there thinking that was awesome. But then even with the Sam Raimi films, and maybe more so with the Amazing Spider-Man films, my enjoyment and appreciation for the movies comes down a little bit. So yeah, I left Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 thinking for each of those, oh, I really like this. But then over the years and upon rewatches, those really weren't that good, even though I agree with what you guys were saying. Andrew Garfield is fun. I like him in the role, but it just happened that the stories weren't done very well.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, I feel like, and maybe I'm being optimistic, but I feel like this is different. It was really fun. It's immersed in this MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Avengers world that I already really like. In fact, in some ways, the movie is dependent on those other movies. That's not necessarily a good thing or bad thing. It's just there's that.
Just
and,
a thing.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I think this is it. I think, well, I ranked it on Letterboxd as my new number one Spider-Man film, right above Spider-Man 2, which most people consider the best of the original three. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I love this movie. I would love to see it again, and the word that comes to mind is just fun. It was just such a fun experience.
Fun. Mm-hmm.
See it, and yeah.
Well, so, oddly enough, when I... towards the end of this movie, I was like, this movie is reminding me of something, just like the feel of it, not specifically like the story or anything specific, but like the feeling that it was giving me while I was watching it. And I realized that I think, as best as I recall or can compare it to, it reminded me of earlier this year when I saw the Lego Batman movie. And in that case, it was just a movie that was fun and had like joke after joke after joke after joke. And then for the most part, knew when to be serious for a little bit and then went back to just being fun. And I think just like the Lego Batman movie, not quite as much, because the Lego Batman movie was like basically a trial in getting as many jokes per minute in as possible. So it's not quite to that level, but that idea that this Spider-Man movie will reward repeat viewings, because you'll probably catch things and little one-liners that you did not catch the first time, because everything's moving so fast and there's so many little Easter eggs and like asides and things that like I know I missed the first time because I was either laughing and I didn't hear the follow-up line, or you know, the audience was laughing. So I just can't wait to see it again. It's, it's to me easily the best Spider-Man movie.
Yeah. What would you say is number two?
I mean, I guess Spider-Man, the second, Sam Raimi Spider-Man, like I remember rewatching before Amazing Spider-Man came out, my wife and I watched all the Sam Raimi movies and I don't know if I should probably admit this, but like, I was like, yeah, I get that Spider-Man 3 is kind of dumb, but is it really that much worse than the other Spider-Man movies? Because they all have this tone that is very kind of silly and like, it's just not real. It felt like at the time it was great because I was like, oh, they made a comic book movie that feels like I'm reading a comic book. It's not taking itself too seriously. Like, Aunt May is punching people or hitting people with her purse or whatever it was. Like, this is all silly and wacky. I mean, the action was good. The action was fun, especially in the second one with Doc Ock and bringing him to life. But for the most part, like, that's not the type of superhero film that I've come to really enjoy. I've really enjoyed this kind of, this Marvel, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but yet still fairly grounded, like what it would look like with superheroes in the real world, not the Sam Raimi version. And so because of that, I actually kind of like the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, because it wasn't perfect, but it was trying to have that tone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like I said, it's really tough for me to say what would be number two. To me, it's kind of like not the Amazing Spider-Man 2, and not Sam Raimi's third one, but everything else is kind of like tied for second for me. Sure. And then this one is easily above them. It's fun. I think it gets all its points across. without having to have someone say, with great power comes great responsibility. They do that in very creative ways. They mix universe. Sony finally lets their guard down and lets Disney in just a little bit. And everyone's been bagging on Disney lately. And I get that Disney's not perfect and they're this big, giant Walmart, McDonald's, Coca-Cola conglomerate, star, you know, Planet Disney at some point in the future. But right now, for my money, I know that if I go to something that, you know, Marvel specifically, but, you know, Disney typically has their hand in, I'm probably not going to regret putting my money down. We even talked about this before.
Yeah.
Like, I even thought the new Pirates movie was kind of middle of the road, but I don't regret going to see it. So, you know, bag on Disney all you want. You know, it stinks that they're doing kind of wacky things with Star Wars, and we won't get to see Phil Lord and Chris Miller make a Han Solo movie. That's a bummer, but, you know, I enjoyed all the Star Wars movies that they made so far. So that's my tangent. We're talking about Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's a home run. I think it's one of the best. It's one of the best Marvel Cinematic Universe movies that I've seen. I think it was like number three or something on my list now.
Well, and you know, you were talking about, you were trying to figure out what the movie felt like to you, and maybe this is just me, but I got a real Back to the Future vibe off of it. Like the fun that I had at Back to the Future, partially because Tom Holland reminds me so much of a young Michael J. Fox in this movie. like he's always like in those, you know, just the way that he gets flustered or the way that he just kind of, you know, I almost wanted him to like scream something to Doc, you know, and he's talking just because of the way he's kind of spastic and everything.
I was putting his palm on his forehead or something.
Yeah. And it's not really a movie like Back to the Future, mm-hmm. but I know it has like a teen movie feel like that to me, that has all the fun and the adventure. And it gets a lot wrong with Spider-Man just because I'm a Spider-Man comic guy and have been for a very long time. So there's parts that I missed, but I think it's a pretty good adaptation to the film. And for people maybe that aren't familiar with the comics, I think it did a really good job. But I thought, man, I like the actor. I hadn't really seen Tom Holland in anything but this. I know he's been in a few things, but I thought, like, he's just a very charming actor, and I think just kind of takes you in, and so you want to kind of root for him. And then you had, like, to me, the worst Marvel villain that I can think of, and they made him one of the best in this. Because, like, Adrian Toomes, it's like, it always seemed like Spider-Man's fighting a 90-year-old guy, you know, in comics. and then somehow, though, just the way Stan Lee or Ditko, whoever it was, when they did Vulture in the comics, he always gave Spider-Man a run for his money. Like, he was always a very, because of the suit that he wore and stuff. But this is like one of the few Marvel films where I actually really cared about the villain too. I love what Michael Keaton did in this, and just knowing that behind the scenes, that whenever they weren't shooting, he would look at Tom Holland and say, "I'm Batman," you know, things like that was pretty fun to find out too. So I think they had a couple things going. If you have a movie, even if it gets away from the source material quite a lot, which I think this one did a lot. It did a lot right, but it did a lot away from it too. But if you have a hero you care about and you have a villain you care about, I think they did something very right with that. So that was,
you know. So let's stick with that. So Matt, you also, just like Rick, have said that you've read Spider-Man comics for quite some time. So what is it that this Spider-Man film does that's right, that either other Spider-Man films haven't done, or even other Marvel films haven't done or haven't been doing, that made you like it so much?
Yeah, I think going back to a younger Spider-Man definitely helped, because when you had Andrew Garfield, they made him a high schooler, but it never really felt like a high schooler. And, you know, Spider-Man, or I should say Peter Parker, is sort of known for being this geeky guy that gets picked on. And you saw some of that in the Sam Raimi films. But when you get to Andrew Garfield, he's, you know, skateboarding around, kind of cool, actually. People seem to not hate him necessarily. So I think going back to the roots of Spider-Man, even though it's set in the modern day, it has the really early Spider-Man feel in the movie, which I think is important. And then tying it into, you know, Spider-Man, I guess I should say again, Peter Parker's real life. So in the early comics, everything sort of revolves around Peter Parker's cast of characters, and all of a sudden how the cast he has as Peter is overlapping with the cast that Spider-Man has, and things are bumping up against each other. And that's what you have here with, and we're going all spoilers. Is that okay here?
Oh yeah. So yeah, if you're listening and you haven't seen Spider-Man, be warned, spoilers, go see the movie first.
Yeah. So having Vulture be the dad of the girl he's pursuing is just classic Peter Parker. That's exactly what would happen to it, because all of a sudden you have this problem he's dealing with as a high schooler intersecting with the problem he's having as a superhero. I loved, just like Rick was just saying, Vulture was awesome. I'm still torn on if he's better than Loki. Those are, I would say, the top two villains in the MCU. But what they did with Vulture, where they set him as a dark mirror image of, and so you have this awesome good father, bad father juxtaposition with, you know, with the good father being Tony to some extent and the bad father being Vulture. I mean, the film went out of their way with visual cues to make us feel like the Vulture is a new kind of evil Iron Man. Well, that stuff was great.
Yeah, and I think one of the best things to get the audience to care about the conflict in the film is to have a really good villain. And to have a really good villain, it's always great and conflicting if the villain can monologue or whatever they do, and you're kind of like, well, he's got a point. Like, so in this film, we basically see Keaton's character, Adrian Toomes, and he's doing exactly what Tony did to get rich. He's basically making weapons and selling them to whoever wants them to provide his income or his wealth or whatever. And there's such a good parallel there, because you can see that he's not doing, like, he still has like kind of standards and morals. Like, he's not just doing this willy-nilly. Like, he's not trying to be a billionaire. He's just trying to make sure that his wife and his child is provided for. And to a certain degree, that's admirable. That's like the whole, like, Les Mis test, you know? Like, if you were starving, would you steal a piece of bread? Is it still wrong? And, you know, like, those moral quandaries that we're in. Like, he was not going to be able to provide for his family because of what Tony Stark... What did he say at the beginning? It was like... That, like, Tony Stark basically created this mess, and now he's getting paid to clean it up.
Right.
You know, yeah, that's great, because, like I said, he is saying true things that you're kind of like, well, I mean, he's got a point. You know, like,
where would you rank him amongst the villains? Would you say he's the top one?
I would say that him and Kingpin are right there for me.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
I guess if you're including Netflix, you can't go wrong with Kingpin. But if you're just looking at the films...
Oh, yeah, if you're just watching the films, I think he slides in behind Loki. And I think the only reason he slides in behind Loki is because Loki's had, what, like three or four films now of appearances where they've had a chance to kind of explore who he is and what he's doing.
Yeah, that makes
sense. So I think if, you know... I'd be interested to see if Toomes, like, shows up later and they continue, like, to see him develop. And, of course, like, Keaton played it great. I mean, he was such a... We had a reconnaissance, and I really feel like after Birdman, we've kind of have, like, a Keaton-onnaissance. I'm not sure if that's too many syllables, a Keaton-onnaissance. Like, the things that I've seen him in, even when they're not that great, I think still think he's great in them. And he brings that, such great duality to this role.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
Yeah, where has he been? He's awesome. It makes me want to go watch a bunch of his other stuff that I haven't seen. Like, or even rewatch Batman.
Like, why did you
The Founder. Yeah.
Yeah, he was great in The Founder. Yeah. And I was... Why did you take 10 years off?
Yeah, why did he take time off?
Yeah, except he probably didn't. Like, there's people. Just
well, he didn't. He was just making movies that were flop after flop, or yeah. just really little independent films. But I don't think he took any time off. Yeah. There.
But that's like I said, it felt like he did, and then now he's back.
Yeah,
he's doing his thing, and oh man, we are all the better for it, which is so great. So I guess since Matt, you kind of started your point with spoiling it, I'm kind of curious. Who saw that coming?
Yeah, I didn't, and especially so. It's kind of a cheat to me because they have different last names, and it's never explained because she's Liz Allen, and he's still Adrian Toomes. Like, it doesn't make any like that's the part of it that really to me is like, I don't know. That's kind of cheating, isn't it? Because you didn't. I mean, they did give little Easter eggs, like she talked about her car, like taillight being hit or something, and there was something with him where he had a phone discussion about had to get a taillight fixed or something. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was like, yeah, I didn't see it coming, and I don't think there was enough for any of us really to see it coming.
So I also didn't see it coming at all. In fact, when he opens the door and he's standing there, the first thing I thought of is how did the vulture figure out who Spider-Man was and end up at his girlfriend's house. Like, it took me about 10 seconds to be like, oh, he's her dad.
Oh, I just wanted to be in the theater with you, like, seeing, like, your kind of, oh, yeah, face.
But, you know, Rick, you had said they had different last names. I'm not 100% positive they ever said Liz's last name in the movie because, you know, for comic fans, we know the character Liz Allen. But did they actually say Liz Allen in the movie? They could have. I just don't remember.
Maybe I just inferred it. I thought they had said Liz Allen at one point, but they might not have.
Yeah, she's only credited as Liz.
Okay, well, that could IMDb, be it.
So,
I probably just heard what I thought I heard then. That's what it was.
I mean, it makes sense. Same for me. I mean, as a person who knows the characters, you just assume, oh, okay, this is their version, the MCU version of Liz Allen.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I assume what the biggest thing that they were doing is it's for good or bad, they were probably just playing on natural cultural assumptions.
Sure.
And, you know, why would old crotchety white Michael Keaton, like, have a black wife, you know?
Right.
There you go. And, you know, the thing that was, I think the thing that sat with me the most about that is that when I wasn't quite like you, Matt, when I wasn't confused why he opened the door, but I realized at that moment that I was supposed to be surprised by it, and I was fully surprised by it. And I felt like it had been a reasonable amount of time since I was that surprised by a film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because Spider-Man was not only fun, like I said, we're throwing around the F word. it was super fun. But I was totally engaged. Like, I never thought about, like, did I have enough popcorn? Did I need to go to the bathroom? Like, do I need to get home in time for the babysitter to be relieved? Like, I was 100% engrossed in this movie to the point where I wasn't trying to think ahead. I wasn't trying to figure out the plot. I wasn't trying to, you know, how is he going to solve this? How is he going to get his suit back? How is he going to resolve things with Tony? Is he going to end up... I didn't care about any of that. I was 100%, like, focused on whatever, you know, Peter Parker was focused on right then. And I think that in and of itself is a credit to the film because, again, there are people, and I think very well-reasoned people who really still like the first two or at least the second Raimi film more, but I never felt that. I always felt like I was watching a movie when I was watching those Spider-Man films. And
yeah,
I like I said, it just totally sucked me in. So, and like I said, I think it's because the stakes were there. I felt like Peter Parker was a real high schooler dealing with real high school problems. The stakes, I think that's the thing. So to answer my own question, like what is this doing different than other Marvel films aren't doing? You know, we talked about this, I think, on like Captain America and Guardians and the Iron Man, you know, all the other ones that we've talked about, even Doctor Strange. Like, the stakes are so ridiculously high. for a solo film. Like, hey, it's Doctor Strange. The entire universe is going to collapse. Like,
yeah.
Where is everybody else? You know, like, Ant-Man, like, they're going to give this weapons, you know, weapons to everybody, and they're going to create an army, and it's going to blow everything up. Oh, wait a minute. Like, where are the rest of the people? So this one was, like, a small, you know, it was Peter Parker trying to figure out, how am I going to get this girl to like me? You know?
Yeah, like, I feel like in some ways, I feel like in some ways too, when you talk about the high school element of this, while I think there's actually an argument to be made, this is very unlike Spider-Man almost the entire movie, like except for the spider suit. I don't think it follows the storyline of Spider-Man at all, almost like at all in the comics. Like, I feel like this is almost its own movie.
Well, can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
Because, so you're saying it doesn't follow Spider-Man at all. Are you talking about just like a specific story or the, like, kind of like the essence of Spider-Man? Because I would say it follows the essence.
That's perfectly. What I mean. Like, I don't think it follows, it's in some things, yes, the essence, but in some ways it's young Iron Man, you know? I mean, in some ways it captures a lot of the fun of, I was just going to say too, though, what they've done with this film is I think they're wanting to introduce it as a new character. It's a lot more like, now I'm saying that from Amazing Spider-Man. I don't think it's a lot like Amazing Spider-Man. I think it's a lot like Brian Michael Bendis's, Ultimate Spider-Man in a lot more in those ways. But what I was going to say about the high school element, which I think is very interesting, is I feel like this movie was made for the high school age people. I mean, it's for everybody, but in some ways, the people that it's really going to relate to is people who don't remember 9/11. Because all I could think about, like, when that plane was coming down was, I don't know if you guys were like this, but because 9/11 is so vivid, but, like, the end of the movie, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to crash like 9/11, you know, it's going to be this huge thing. But I feel like like you were talking about, the story itself is not like this world-shattering villain moment. It's something that is kind of self-contained, and he's going to try to save the fair that we saw, you know, in the first Iron Man movie. So it's just interesting to me just the way that it was made, because I think one reason that so many superhero movies got so dour and dark was partially as a response, you know, ever since 9/11, we've just been people, you know, my age and around my age are just cynical people, you know? Mm-hmm. And yet I think with teens and people that this movie, like where Peter Parker is supposed to be at that age, I think it's a lot more hopeful in a lot of ways. It feels like that anyway, the teens that I talk to at my church or wherever I'm at. And a lot of them are young enough that they don't remember, you know, like the tragedy of 9/11 or things like that, or it's a very vague memory for them. A lot of them don't even remember the Phantom Menace. You know, it's mm-hmm. like they're old enough at this point that, like, you know, like this is something that'll relate to them. So it is like a comic book in the fun of the comic book, and it makes you want to come back for more. But I think there's a lot of elements that are really far from it too. And I mean, I've made a list actually of things like Ned is like Gonky in the Superior comics. I don't know if you guys have, not Superior, but the Ultimate comics. I don't know if you've read him. I don't know why Ned Leeds is him, because that was not Ned Leeds from the comic at all. Betty Brant, why is she Gwen Stacy? You know, like, why is Michelle MJ and why is, you know, the Liz Allen thing? Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But the thing I think that they removed most, if we're talking about making it most unlike the comic to me, is there's no Uncle Ben at all in this. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was Spidey's motivation through all of it. And he's the reason that Spider-Man sort of has this conscience in the first place, that with great power must also come great responsibility. And I think we've replaced Uncle Ben in this Marvel universe and the movies with Tony Stark. And I just find that interesting. I think it works well in the movie, and I think it's fun in the movie, but I just think it's like pretty far from, you know, where Spider-Man started as, you know, because he was always desperately trying to get the Avengers' attention in the comics and wanted to be an Avenger, but he also had a really bad temper, and that was what kept him from being an Avenger. in those early like Spider-Man comics, and he was always a loner and the law was always after him and everything. So anyway, I've talked too much. I'll let you guys talk, but those are just some of my observations about, you know, when we're talking about if it's like the comic or if it isn't. But
well, to give Matt a chance to jump in on something he may or may not care about, I want to take what you said, Rick. I think most of the criticisms that you just laid out were things that I don't think fundamentally change who Spider-Man is. Except, I mean, because, like, you know, changing character names, changing how characters look, kind of the age of characters, kind of what some of these peripheral sure. characters do or their main roles are. That, like, I feel like there's a lot of room there, but you can still have the essence of Spider-Man. The one sure. thing you are saying that changed that I think would change the essence or change the Spider-Man and how we understand him is the fact that there's no Uncle Ben. But we've had so many Spider-Man origin stories that I think almost no one needs a Spider-Man origin story. So I'm sure. I'm curious, Matt, like they've reinvented Spider-Man again. You know, they've changed his age. Aunt May is young and apparently hot, and everyone in the city wants her. Like, do they need an Uncle Ben to make Spider-Man Spider-Man?
Well, it has to exist in his history, but we don't need to see it again. I mean, Spider-Man's origin has become the same as Batman's origin, where I think we're all done with seeing Batman's parents get killed in an alley.
Yeah, and it's normal cultural knowledge right now. Like, if you know anything about the character, you know how he got started.
Yeah, so at this point, we know Spider-Man got bit by a radioactive spider, got powers, screwed up, his uncle died, and now he knows he's got to be responsible. So I don't think we needed to see it, and they made a few references, although the name Ben was never mentioned. I thought that was kind of interesting. But there were some things, and I do agree with Rick on the point that he made about in some ways it was Spider-Man in this movie became like a junior Iron Man. So one of the things I think makes Spider-Man who he is that he often had to make a way for himself. He was always down on his luck, and that's not what we saw here. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing in the long run, because I don't, you know, Rick had mentioned some of the differences between the comic and the movie. I don't think it bothers me that the MCU and Marvel Studios are making their own versions of the characters. I'm fine with that. And if they don't line up with the exact stories I heard of, that's fine. This is just a new character. But I think fundamentally Spider-Man does have to kind of be a person who's, like I said before, down on his luck and trying to figure out how to make things work almost on his own. And that's not what we see here when we see Tony literally giving him the iconic costume that we all know Spider-Man as wearing.
Right.
It does make him instantly an Avenger, even though he's not technically on the team. So you could look at it one or two ways. Either they're taking that away from Spider-Man, or they're trying to give him something. And that's what I'm leaning towards, that they're, in a sense, passing the torch. Symbolically, we've got Tony Stark giving Peter Parker this special costume that's similar to his. And we know in the long run, Robert Downey Jr. can't stick around as Iron Man forever. So someone else needs to become the face of the MCU. I don't know contract-wise how that's going to work with Sony and Disney and Marvel and all that stuff, but I could see in the long run that this was a passing of the torch, and now Spider-Man is going to become the new face of the MCU. It still kind of bugs me a little bit that this movie was so on some of the past movies. Like, you couldn't really go into this movie and fully appreciate it without having a good knowledge of what happened in the first Avengers movie, Captain America Civil War, and I think those are probably the main two because of the opening sequence. But you, in a sense, you would have to at least know a little bit about his origin, like we were just talking about also, so maybe some of the past Spider-Man films, just origin-wise. So I don't think you could go into this one as a first movie to kick off a new Heroes franchise totally. You couldn't go in here totally blind and just appreciate it. You had to know some things about it. So to come back around to your original question, does Spider-Man need Uncle Ben? No, not in the film, but it does have to, that character has to exist in Spider-Man's history for the whole thing to be truly Spider-Man.
Yeah, and I think when you talk about things that you could level against every movie, I think that is the idea that basically since Avengers, you really don't get all you can out of the movie unless you've seen previous films. So the idea that you can't get everything out of, like, you can't truly get everything there is out of Spider-Man without seeing, like, the Avengers and probably Civil War, like, I get that, but I think it's a bonus. I think they set it up enough and they reference kind of what's going on enough to where you can infer anything else that you need. Because, like I said, there's a good chance that you're not going to see Spider-Man unless you at least understand what probably happened in Avengers.
Yeah.
You know, like, sure, you didn't see Ant-Man, you didn't see Doctor Strange, that's fine. You know, you didn't see Thor 2, you're good. But, like, you probably know what happens in Avengers. Except probably Civil War. So I feel like you can level that criticism against most of the Marvel movies, but I think that's just one of those things they're willing to eat at this point. They're just kind of like, don't care, you know.
Yeah,
we kind of assume that this is how it is. Now, when it comes to Ben himself, I'll say this. One, I'm glad that we didn't get to see another Spider-Man origin story. I'm tired. I don't want to see it again.
Yeah.
Especially if it's going to take up lots of my runtime. Because I really don't see how they do that story that much different, creatively or whatever. I can see enough in Peter Parker as a character. I know he's super young. And so he kind of, like, everything's really cool to him and all the other, you know, attributes that we would attribute to people his age. Like, wow, cool, great, I'm videoing everything, you know, that whole exciting life. But I still feel like he's mature enough that it's not impossible for me to think that as a young kid, he had that Uncle Ben moment. And like most kids would, it probably impacted him for a while. It has steered him on the direction that he's on, but it's not like he frets over it every day of his life. So to bring him into the MCU, what they have done, they have kind of replaced that haunting, you know, Uncle Ben voiceover in his head with Tony, the surrogate father. And I think this is where almost nothing they've changed really bothers me in Spider-Man, because I do think that both of you, especially Matt, you were kind of pointing out how typically we see Peter Parker as like a down on his luck. I mean, like we see him in the other Spider-Man films, like he's always broke, he's always poor, he's always trying to figure out a way to get by. He's always kind of scrapping just to be Peter Parker. And it's almost impossible that he can also be Spider-Man. And we don't see that because he's been given this suit. But I think two things happen in this movie that hold the essence of who Spider-Man is together. One is the suit's taken from him.
Mm-hmm.
So when the suit's taken from him, we see him as Peter Parker, and it looks a lot like the Peter Parker who doesn't have a whole lot. Now, he's in high school, so it's not like he's out like trying to pay his rent, you know, taking pictures of Spider-Man for J. Jonah Jameson. Like, we don't have him at that point yet. It's probably what he would look like if Tony withdrew that help. So he still has to learn how to be Peter Parker. He still needs to learn how to make the right decisions, even when he doesn't get the easy road. Even when Flash has the nicer car to prom, you know, like, he's still in this cycle. He doesn't stay there for like a large chunk of his life, like we see, but he's still being molded by this idea. And the second part is with Tony. Tony is basically forcing him to do the "with great power comes great responsibility" thing. He is pushing him down and saying, you know, in the most probably unbiblical way possible, being very biblical, saying that, like, if you can be trusted with little, you know, then we'll talk about being trusted with much. And he, you know, it's probably a wise thing to do with, like, a high schooler. not to let him try to, like, save the world, just trying to watch him. And he's kind of, especially by the end of the film, like, showing, Tony's showing his intentions, saying, you know, you were a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, and you did well. You know, we didn't listen to you at times, we finally did, we realized that you've got what it takes, your heart's in the right place, and then they kind of offer him more. Which is, again, they're testing the great power comes great responsibility idea. They've just kind of freshened it up so we can see it in action over the arc of a film instead of just being like this haunting, like, Jedi ghost thing that he hears when he's trying to be Peter Parker instead of Spider-Man.
Sure.
And so ultimately, I don't feel like the film is betraying anything that any picture that I have of Spider-Man.
Well, I was going to say that too, because the suit gets taken away. I mean, I did like he makes his own web fluid and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think we needed to see that, you know, one thing that's very key about Peter Parker is his ingenuity, and he's incredibly smart. And so I think we needed to see, like, that he knew science and chemistry and all those things, because that was so much to the character. And I agree with you. If they hadn't taken the suit away, I would have walked away thinking, that was great. But, I mean, it really was, like Matt just said, Iron Man Jr. Mm-hmm. And one thing to me, too, I loved, and this is going to be shooting towards the end of the movie, but one of the key moments in Spider-Man comics is the Master Planner storyline that takes place in Amazing Spider-Man 30 through 33. And I think, Matt, I think you and I talked about this on the podcast.
Yeah, we did.
Together. On Voices in My Head. And there's one scene that they actually reenacted in this film from that. And it was great when he's, and again, it's this hero moment of him having to be who he is, without the help of anybody else. And it's, you know, towards the end of the movie when he's trapped under the rubble, and it's dire. And when you read those old Stan Lee comics, and like, it's a different villain and everything in the original comics, it's Doc Ock. And Spider-Man's actually trapped underwater, and water is rising, but he's under all this rubble, and he has a cold, and he just is completely tapped out of strength, and he's crushed under the rubble. And it's just like you see in the film, really. And in this movie, he's crunched under the rubble. And I was watching it, and I was like, I can't believe I'm seeing this on film, like the most important key moment in Spider-Man comics. Because so to me, I'm like, I was getting teary almost watching that part. I was sobbing almost as hard as Tom Holland was under that rubble. No, I wasn't sobbing like that, but it was a powerful moment to me, because that's, I mean, I have the original comic, like the actual original, not a reprint or anything, because I love that storyline so much. I just wish it would have lasted a little bit longer. But when he was trapped under the rubble, even, I mean, it was, I don't know if, I think you guys would probably agree with me, it was pretty dire for him at that point. I mean, the way he's crying and the way that he's like he just can't move. And in that original storyline, like, he absolutely is spent and has no strength left. And he has to kind of summon everything within him, and the thing you don't get in the film that you do in the original comic is he starts thinking about Aunt May, and he starts thinking about all this responsibility that he has, and he just can't die there. He has to summon the strength within inside of him, and he has to be more than what he feels like he is. And so it really kind of comes back around to that moment where Tony says to him, you know, if you're nothing without this suit, then you're nothing, or I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like that. Then you don't deserve the suit, yeah, or something. And so we do get that, like, really key moment of Spider-Man comics, where he has to push himself beyond where he has ever pushed himself before. I just loved that scene of the movie. I've heard people complain of, like, I can't believe Spider-Man's crying or whatever. But I think if you were a teenager and you're trapped under a building and you can't move, I think that's about as dire a situation as you could be in, you know? So I thought that was probably my favorite part of the film, just capturing that. And I was just so geeking out that like, they got the comic, like, they read this, you know?
Yeah, I actually, Rick, I totally agree. When that scene came on, I was thinking the same thing as you, that that's a powerful moment in his history. And I think it made the viewing experience more powerful for me knowing that history. So Fizz, I don't know if you had read that in the past, but if you hadn't, how did that scene hit you?
I hadn't read it. I have sadly read scarce few Spider-Man comics, which is unfortunate considering how much I like him. But that particular scene was like impactful, but it didn't stir great emotion in me. Like it seemed functional. I was like, this is the scene where this is like the dark night of the soul. You know, this is where he's got to overcome and he's got to do it without any help. So I was rooting for him. But it didn't stir memories of like another story that really meant a lot to me.
Right.
Well, yeah, you know, interesting.
I'll say this real quick, Rick. You had also said that quote from Tony where he said, if you're nothing without the suit, then you shouldn't have it. And to me, I feel like that quote became the new, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
That's the theme of the film for Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, so something I do want to talk about, you know, it's obviously called Spider-Man. So we're talking a lot about Spider-Man himself and the arc that he's on and the, you know, kind of like the things that he's learning and how he's growing and going on these thematic arcs. But honestly, I kind of want to talk about Tony for a second, because something that I've been thinking about since I saw the first trailer that had that line in it, which is a little bit of a bummer because it's the kind of line that I don't want to hear until the movie. Where is there not like just pounds and pounds of irony just weighing down that line, the fact that it's coming from Tony Stark?
Yeah. Yeah, because he does everything with tech and without the suit. Yeah, he's... it's very ironic. You're right.
I think that's something that maybe Tony has learned, because I think he had to learn that when he was in the cave in the first Iron Man movie. I don't feel like he acts in ways that would back that up, and you know, almost everything since escaping the cave with the terrorists or whatever. But it is interesting to see that like one of the only life lessons that Tony has to impart into, you know, young Peter Parker is one of the only things that it looks like he's actually learned in his time of being the center of his own universe.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't disagree with you. I think it's interesting. I think Tony took a turn in Civil War that I didn't see coming, because up until that time, I feel like he became a different character in Civil War than we've ever seen in any of the Iron Man films too.
Mm-hmm.
Because in all of them up until then, he's this real irresponsible, just, you know, he can be kind of douchey at times even to people, mm-hmm. and just, you know, no responsibility for anybody, and was kind of always flaky even with Pepper. And in the Civil War film, I think almost because they needed him to do it for the plot, you know, they like made him into a different character that he hadn't been before. And he's very uncharacteristic of Tony. And I think that's kind of in the comics too, when they did Civil War, I think they changed Tony Stark a lot and, you know, made him the one that was very much, you know, rah-rah pro-government. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, because we all know that billionaire industrialists want more regulation by the government. so, like, that was something that struck me odd in the comics, and it struck me odd in Civil War, too. So you're right, because it doesn't feel like, to me, it feels like the person that should be that mentor for him in this movie that probably makes more sense and is actually like this in the comics is Captain America. Because there's a lot of comics where Spider-Man is like, oh my goodness, I look up so much to Captain America. And I don't think he really has that with Iron Man in the storyline. And I feel like it would make a lot of sense with Steve being that for him, because they are very similar characters in sort of like their you know, homegrown wholesomeness and kind of growing up from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tony has always had money and he's always been rich and he's always been kind of irresponsible and, you know, just a womanizer. So it's interesting. I wonder if like the Captain America movies and if Captain America had become the character that Iron Man became, if this movie wouldn't have actually been instead of Iron Man as sort of the father figure, if I wonder what the movie would look like if Steve was the father figure to the Spider-Man, this, because that would be really interesting to me as well.
Well, to be fair, I think that Captain America was probably shaping and molding young Peter Parker through his, you know, his informational and morale boosting videos. So,
yes, especially especially the after credits one.
Yes. Oh, the after credits scene. So, like, totally unrelated to anything. And I guess if you're listening to this, you've seen the movie now. But has there ever been a better post-credit scene?
It was pretty great. I can't think of a better one. Maybe shawarma, but
yeah, all the post-credit scenes, whether it's the very, very end, tend to be on the more humorous side. So yeah, I don't know if you can beat that.
Yeah, I mean,
that whole thing throughout the movie was awesome. I loved when Captain America pointed to where the gym teacher should be. Yeah, there was some really great humor in this movie.
Oh, gosh. It was just so great. I mean, it was just so funny on so many levels. Like, I was internally giddy because of how clever it was. Like, it's like breaking the fourth wall, but it's also not, because it's also a recurring joke. But it's also a joke that technically works on lots of levels based on seeing Captain America, the first Avenger, seeing the second Avengers movie. Like, it just, it's a callback and yet so completely original. I want to do like a standing, like, slow clap to whoever came up with that idea.
So. Yeah, it was really funny. It was one of the highlights of the film for sure. As far as comedy, I mean, it just worked.
So, I guess get back to something slightly more serious, though. I still want to talk a little bit more about Tony. And, Matt, I kind of want to hear your opinion. Like, this film is a Spider-Man film. But obviously they've put Tony Stark in this film to really hammer home the connection to the MCU. And I think it's not just something that was tacked on. I do feel like, personally, I have opinions on, like, Tony's character. But do you... or did you notice or feel that Tony's character really grew in this film, or do you feel like he was just tacked on?
No, I don't feel like he was tacked on, but then but the question of did he grow, I don't know if he grew other than maybe recognizing, yes, Peter's 15 years old, but he's smart and he knows what's going on and I should be listening to what he has to say. So maybe he recognized that Peter was a better resource and a more helpful hero than he originally thought. But I don't know if his character changed that much. But, I mean, even when you bring up Tony, it is kind of interesting that in some ways, because he was ignoring Peter all along, I mean, there's some aspects of him, again, just like in Civil War, where he was a kind of villain type. I'm not saying he's a villain of this film, but... if this is, you know, a lot of people had talked about beforehand that this would be kind of in the vein of John Hughes. And if that's what you're looking at, then Tony is the adult figure who doesn't respect the teen, with the teen being the protagonist. It does kind of make Tony out to be sort of this mean guy that should be listening, but he's not. And I just really want his affection. And he's pushing me out the door as I'm trying to give him a hug. there's all sorts of things where, again, he's not Vulture level villain, but he's not necessarily a hero in this story. But then at the very end, he comes around, and it's just like in some of those 80s movies where the parents kind of see the light and they're nice to their kids, and that's what Tony is. He's like a 1980s movie dad.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, he is an obstacle. He's not a villain, but he is an obstacle that that has to be overcome. So what I liked about Tony is the fact that he is taking on a role that he has not. But I think that he's wanted. Because I think he wants to be what Captain America basically naturally slid into with the Avengers. Mm-hmm. Like, he wanted to be kind of the father. He, like, I feel like most of Civil War is Tony trying to be the responsible dad. Like, we've created these crazy things. We've brought this craziness here. It's our responsibility to contain the crazy and do the adulting and create a registry and, you know, have more rules and, like I said, like bedtimes and, you know, curfews and, you know, watching people and protocols, what the training wheels protocol, you know, things like that. Like, that, like, he's wanting that in the Avengers, and he finally gets a chance to be the father. And I use that term loosely, but I think that he wants to do it, and I think he gets to do it in a very detached way. So I don't want to give him, like, mad props for being a great dad or an adoptive father, necessarily. But he even seems to surprise himself, like, at the end of the movie, being like, oh, I gave good advice. Like, I have some kind of fathering thing in me, even though I was not fathered very well. And I think him realizing this, you know, we see him kind of finally, even though it's tongue-in-cheek, going after things that he wants and not just saying, oh, well, like having the ring for Pepper. And, like you say, again, very tongue in cheek, very Tony Stark-esque, but it's still the fact that, like, he would make that leap. I feel like there's just a little bit of character development in Tony in this movie that if you go straight to, it almost like humanizes him again, from after you've seen Civil War. Like, I think if you go to the next whatever movie Iron Man's going to be in, Infinity War, or wherever he shows up again, and he's got some of this change behind him, this almost nurturing, caring for someone, safety above his own, and you didn't see Spider-Man, it's going to be weird.
Oh, totally. And if you think big picture, go back to Captain America Civil War, Tony was, in that case, one of the villains of that movie, not the same as what I was just saying for kind of in a humorous way here, but he needed to be in Spider-Man before we get to Avengers 3 so that we'll like him again, because he became, I mean, I guess people can say, I can see where he's coming from. Some people have a hard time deciding whose side to be on, but I think Tony was basically the antagonist of Civil War overall. So yeah, he needed to be in this role here so that when we get to the next Avengers, we can be on board with whatever he does. But I think it's interesting what you said about him growing up with not no father, but an absent father and one that he wasn't very close with. So I do wonder if the character has wanted to be able to restore that in himself by being a father figure, and he doesn't have his own kids. And so, yeah, Peter does give him that chance. And then is there a correlation then where he's able to be this father figure, and in that movie, not in an Iron Man movie, but in that movie where he becomes a father figure, he takes next step relationally and is prepared to propose to Pepper. Mm-hmm. Like, is there a correlation there, or is that just happening in Spider-Man because they're not going to make an Iron Man 4?
Yeah, because they're just not. Well, so I'll say this. What it reminds me of, this real-life parallel, is I probably mentioned on some episode before, especially when it comes to fathers. Like, I know a lot of my guy friends or guy acquaintances who have had either absent fathers or, like, only barely physically present fathers, but there's, like, no nurture there. There's no actual fathering happen, as I think many of us would define fatherhood. And based on how they treated other people's children, I mean, to a great extent, this includes myself, there was some trepidation on them becoming fathers, because it's like, I remember being told, when I first attempted to date my wife, I remember being told that I did not have, like, a father, that was a particular type of father. So I would never be able to be a particular type of husband and father.
Hmm.
And that stuck with me. Because I do realize there is some power to having a good example set for you, right? Like, right. Hey, I can, like, there's some really good stuff here. Let me learn. I don't have to learn everything on my own. Now over time I've realized that, the work of Christ in me, like the work of the Holy Spirit in my life, is much greater than any example that I could have had. But I have seen so many of my friends become fathers. And I remember, like I said, I had trepidation. I was like, what are they going to be like a father? Because I saw their fathers, and their fathers were terrible. And these friends of mine, on the whole, have been great dads. Like, and it's been amazing to see, like, them basically redeeming what fatherhood looks like in their life from the example that they were given, and how that has made them better husbands, better friends. I mean, just generally, I mean, as much as we can define better, all the things that come along with it, they've become better people. They're more tender. They are other-centric. They seem to enjoy life more. And it's just been really refreshing because I believe fatherhood is being redeemed in that family line. And now, I don't think, you know, this is one of those things where we're trying to Jesus juke anything. but I think I really enjoyed Tony's character in this movie, because in his way, in a way that is still, again, tongue-in-cheek, it's very funny, it's very kind of sarcastic, and quick-witted, I feel like Tony is redeeming, like, basically family, or what family looks like to him. And I think it's affecting him, and I hope that it's not just something that I'm picking up on because it just happened to be circumstantial in this movie. I'm hoping that it continues to carry out and he becomes a more other-centric, caring person, understanding, not trying to trick people or force people into his plan. So, and like I said, I see that because he offers Peter the suit at the end, right? And it looks like he's got a plan if Peter accepts it, and he's perfectly fine if Peter doesn't. More proud if Peter doesn't. Like, he ends up being like, oh, that's the right decision. I have helped shape this young mind, and I acknowledge, like, he's not making the same choice that Tony would have made, that young Tony would have made, and he sees that as a victory. So, again, I'm not trying to Jesus juke the film. I'm not trying to put, like, some kind of redemption story where the writers of Spider-Man Homecoming are not trying to put it, but that's what it makes me think about. And that's what it makes me hope for a Tony Stark.
Yeah, I mean, and what? Go ahead, Rick.
Well, I was just going to say, I think I've seen a trend. I may have even talked about this the last time when I was on your show here, but it seems like I'm seeing a trend in movies in general aimed at people who have not had fathers, or, you know, are desperately, like, in need of father figures. Mm-hmm. I think I see that a lot in movies now. It's just, and maybe it's because the filmmakers that are making movies now, I think maybe a lot of them have had that experience of not having good dads. And so, yeah, I do think we get a lot of that in here. I think even in some ways, Happy, that's his name, right? That John Favreau played.
Yeah, what's
his name?
Happy.
Yeah. I think in some ways he's almost even like a gruff. You know, like, he's the grumpy dad that's like, you know, he's driving the car, leave me alone, you know, get in the backseat. But there's all these, you know, even he in the end is sort of he's comic relief throughout, but even he is sort of this father figure. There's a lot of people, though, you know, without fathers. You know, Tony has lost his, Peter has lost his real dad, he's lost his uncle. I mean, we don't mm-hmm. see that in the film, but we know that's part of it.
Yeah.
And I think, again, if we're talking about high schoolers and just what we know of a lot of kids, and I know, Matt, even you, you know, have been one of those people that didn't have the ideal dad situation, having dad around. I think there's probably something that, and you could speak to this for sure, but there's probably something in there that speaks to you on a real level of like, wow, you know, it's great to see someone kind of stepping into that father role where a person didn't have it, you know?
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's true. I don't know if you know this, Fizz, but I didn't know my dad growing up and, wasn't connected to him and had to track him down. So didn't meet him until I was 23 when I had kind of done some detective work to find him and send him a letter and be like, I'm your son. And it was all crazy, but I'm still to this day, and we're still building a relationship. It's been over 10 years and that's still a process, but because of where I came from and knowing what it's like to grow up with a father, I was really moved by what you were saying earlier and just thinking, man, it kills me that somebody said something to you that really stuck with you. Cause I know it happens, to somebody like me, to other people that, are in a similar situation, and it's crazy how having Christ in your life can change what would usually happen. Like when it comes to bad things, relationally could be a part of your life because of not having a dad, but with, you know, having this, then you are able to start something new for your family. So, I mean, for me, I know with my two kids and my wife, it's just a huge on my heart that I want to start something new, a new track for my family this way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's, mm-hmm. And I didn't necessarily pick up exactly on what you said, Tony, that we're talking about. And now I see it, but I mean, there was right away that I saw the theme of Vulture, as sort of the bad dad and Tony as sort of the good dad. I saw that, but this taking it to that other level. Yeah. It does really resonate with me. So I'm glad you shared that.
Well, and that's the thing that I would say. I don't even know if I would use good dad and bad dad in regards to Tony, or Vulture. I think the beauty of fatherhood that it's portrayed in this movie, again, probably not exceptionally intentionally by the writers, is the fact that I would describe both of those dads or dad figures as human dads making decisions. And I think that's what makes Keaton's bad guy one of the best Marvel villains. Because if you're a dad, you go, I kind of get why he's doing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love my family, and I will do anything for my family. And it's like I said, it's tough to argue with the guy who's just trying to put food on the table. Now, it looks like he's putting really nice food on the table. and definitely no food in that very nice car. But like the idea is there. Like it's easy to get behind a guy who's just trying to make decisions that are for his family. Like I said, he doesn't look like he's going around like Tony is, like flaunting his money, driving in Lamborghinis, picking up women. Like he is literally trying to be a family man. So like I said, it's hard for me to use words like good and bad. But I think it's a lot easier for me to just label them as human, like human dads trying to make decisions. Tony trying to figure it out, you know, kind of stumbling along the way, happening to make some slightly better decisions. You know, Toombs, unfortunately, making the only decision he feels he has options with. But a decision that still, again, I don't think is him centric. So it's hard to be mad at him, you know, as a villain, which is a great villain because he's still doing things that he shouldn't be doing. So
there you go. Just on one other side note, speaking of fathers and father figures that are not present in this story, I've always kind of thought of J. Jonah Jameson in the comics, as being like, in some ways, I'm like, he's a terrible jerk in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And he hates Spider-Man, but there's always this other side of it. He always is sort of this father figure to Peter Parker too. He's like a terrible dad, but then when push came to shove, if somebody messed with him, like, you know, he was always there for Peter in some ways. And in this movie, I think that's interesting that we just don't have him at all. There's no presence of like the Daily Bugle or some of those iconic type characters that have in some ways in the past served. Because I think in a lot of Peter Parker, now that I'm thinking through all this father stuff, a lot of Peter Parker is him always searching for someone to be his dad, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think he wants it to be like Jonah in some regard, you know, he's always looking for approval from him and he never gets it. Or, you know, he can't get approval from Uncle Ben because Uncle Ben's not there anymore. He's desperately trying to get Tony's approval in this film. And it seems like he's, you know, even back in like Civil War, he's so respectful of, you know, even as he's webbing up Captain America's shield, he's like, you know, hi, sir, you know, things like that. So there really is a lot to Peter's character about him trying to realize what kind of a man he wants to be throughout all this. And I think there's a pivotal moment even in at the very end, since it is Spider-Man Homecoming, when they're at Homecoming and he has to flake out again, you know, on Liz, because he knows, you know, the kind of man that he needs to be is the kind of man that has to leave the dance and leave the girl where he really wants to be, because he's got to stop, you know, this guy. And that gets to the core of who Spider-Man is too. He's got to make these really hard decisions and they almost always blow up in his face. You know, when he does the right thing, it almost never works out for him. He's kind of like the opposite of, you know, what prosperity gospel preachers tell us, you know, as a character, because he's always doing the right thing. And at least in the comic storylines, he just gets nothing but grief for it. And yet he still perseveres and tries to do his very best in all situations. And yeah. I do like that in this film, it does capture that he's not perfect and he doesn't always, even when he's trying to make the right choice, he doesn't always make the right choice. But I think he does the very best that he can. And strives to be a better person. So I think that there's a lot to be said for Spider-Man is a character that's always seeking a dad in some ways.
I do think it's kind of funny that there seems to be like some type of inverse line graph that's like the more virtuous decision he makes as Spider-Man, the more difficult his life as Peter Parker is.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
Just raising the personal stakes of something again, yeah. Not having to have the world about to blow up, but just like internal stakes.
Sure.
Just being appropriately tuned for the film I'm watching.
And you know, if we were going to look for like a Christian analogy through that, that might be one of the better ones we have, because I do think in our journey to follow Christ, we actually don't get relieved of our problems by following. We actually get a whole new set of problems we wouldn't have had if we didn't decide to follow Jesus in the first place, mm-hmm. you know? So I think we see that a lot in this character. So
when I know we've talked about this on previous episodes, but it's like, I feel like I've run into so many people over the past probably year who honestly believe that like God's goal for his creation is for us to be happy. And I'm just like, that's so shallow though. Like, is that all you want? Like, is that all he wants? Like, just for you to be happy? Because it's, I mean, happiness is one, it's fleeting, it's unfulfilling, it's temporary. There's just so much more. So I feel like I want to get into it again, but then again, I'm just going to be rehashing what we've rehashed on at least, I think, two other episodes. So,
sure.
Well, let's start to kind of bring this ship in, this ferry. Let's bring this ferry back together, you know?
All right. Yeah. Good one.
I see what you did there. Where's the memes when you do? So in any film, there is usually a chance to say, come on, or what were you doing? So Matt, was there any time during this movie that kind of made you just kind of, I don't know, scratch your head, things that you just really didn't like or wish that wouldn't gone down the way they did? Or again, as usual, yeah, made you say, come on.
Yeah, you know, I love this one. I ended up giving it 4.5 out of 5.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot to complain about, but I am sort of curious on why they decided to make the Michelle character MJ. Because when she says that, that whole scene is just awkward. Because she says, my friends call me MJ. And then he says, I didn't know you had friends. And she says, I don't. So it's almost like she's just saying, I want you guys to just start calling me MJ. Like she's saying, you guys are my friends. And I just made up this awesome new nickname for myself, MJ.
It totally fit with her character, though. She's always going around saying dumb things, and then they're like, no.
I don't hate the character, and I guess I don't ultimately really care if they want to start calling her MJ. I'm guessing it's, to the audience, a clue that this will be Peter's romantic interest, or at minimum that she'll become best friends and find out he's Spider-Man and all that stuff. So it's not the end of the world, just a little bit of a come on, head scratcher.
Well, so let me ask you this, because I don't disagree with you, but do you think back on the movie now and see where she seemed very, or knowing that she is, for all accounts, going to be MJ, you go back and look at all her lines and her interactions with Peter and Ned and kind of say, oh yeah, it seemed like they may have been hinting at this anyway, because she's obviously like hanging around and she has to multiple times say that she's not obsessed with Peter kind of thing.
Well, yeah, there's definitely clues that she's interested in Peter, but just like we were talking about before, they're making new characters out of, like, you get a name and then put it on a brand new character. So that doesn't bug me at all. I'm totally fine with her being a brand new character. In some ways I would have almost just liked it better if they just let her be Michelle and she's a new character and she doesn't get MJ, and everything that comes with that tied to her. She just becomes her own character. But it, again, to me, this is not a deal breaker. I don't have a lot to complain about with this movie.
Catch him.
Yeah.
I guess. Sorry, Rick, real quick. I guess the only thing I had already mentioned, there is a part of me that doesn't love how much Peter was reliant on Tony and how much it's the story is reliant on past things. But Fizzy made a great point. At this point, all these films really do call back to each other. So I always have to be okay with that. I guess if Peter could have maybe at least just made his own costume, like not the homemade one, but if he had made the iconic costume, it would have been a little less believable, but I think I would have liked it a little more.
Yeah.
But whatever, it's not the end of the world. Okay, go ahead, Rick, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, to tack on to yours, I thought she was going to be Michelle Gonzalez, who is a character that looks a lot like her in the comic and has been in the comics recently. So I thought, oh, she's Michelle Gonzalez. Nope, she's NJ. That makes no sense.
I was going to say, I wonder if they're just kind of like nodding to both of those.
Maybe. Could very well be. But yeah.
So Rick, is that kind of the same thing for you, or is there something else that you want to mention?
You know what really bothered me in this movie? Like, I can get behind so much in this film that's not like the comics. It was just a fun film for me, and it doesn't have to be straight off the page Spider-Man. So I'm okay with that. What really bugged me, though, honestly, like, it was the F, Mary, Kill part of it, where these teenagers are sitting around. And I know high schoolers talk it in way more vulgar ways than we usually show in movies and stuff. But it's the inference. You could tell this was like Sony and not Disney Marvel in some ways, because you've got all these teens that, I don't know, I tend to think of Spider-Man, and if we're putting a movie towards kids, I don't want to like draw attention to the F word or even, you know, just things like that. It just seemed off, and it wasn't necessary, I don't think, in the film. And so I could have done without that. And I know it probably makes me seem like a prude or something, but I remember thinking like, that really doesn't set well with me. in the context of like where we're at in this particular kind of film, it would like, if I was watching it with my son, who's too young right now to know anyway, but it would be, I hate moments that are like cringe inducing, that if I was going to watch this movie where I would watch it with my son one day, and then all of a sudden, like, I hate when I'm in films and all of a sudden parents would get uncomfortable, kids would get uncomfortable, I don't understand why they do that in films, to where everybody couldn't have a good time throughout the film, you know, where they have to bring in something that obviously I think would make conversation awkward if you're talking about it afterwards or something. So for me, that was kind of like the low point, other than the MJ stuff. I didn't really care for that, but again, that was probably just because I'm an old prude, but that'd be mine that I really didn't like.
So I can agree with you that, especially considering the rest of the tone of the film, or at least the suitableness for younger viewers, it probably mm-hmm. was on the, you know, the more crass side of anything that happened. But I actually really liked it, because I basically think if you're trying to give credibility, like what would high schoolers be doing in a world where the Avengers existed? Mm-hmm. I totally see teenagers sitting around, like, basically playing that exact game, asking that about the Avengers. So it actually made me think, all those girls are real girls that I would probably meet if I went to a high school. So it helped. It probably wasn't necessary. And it also lended credence to what many assume is a reference to Deadpool. So that was also a positive in...
Yeah, well, I got that, and I totally, like, and I know that, again, I was in high school. I understand how crass, Rick. I understand how crass and vulgar it gets, but to me, it was like, did it have to be in Spider-Man? Like, so I get it, and then
Rick, you're so old.
I am. I get that I'm old, and to high schoolers, I would seem ancient. I'm sure. So.
Like, he's still alive.
Yeah, he Rick James. He's the guy that died in the, yeah. Anyway,
I
get that. I felt like in this movie it felt weird.
Yeah,
and but yeah, to each their own. I get it. So.
So I was trying to think of, something that made me say that, and.
Oh, you know what? Right along with that, if you don't mind me.
No, go ahead.
Tacking on.
I literally have nothing.
It's the same concept of when they had to keep calling him Penis Parker, you know, type thing. And I heard somebody talking about that, said, you know, I had my little girl with me who was, you know, again, we were there for like a daddy daughter date night, and then all of a sudden, like, it got this real awkward thing, like, great, we're in this movie about superheroes, and all of a sudden I just didn't want to have that conversation with my daughter tonight, you know, however it was. And so to me, I get that. I guess I get that high schoolers are going to be like that, and that is the cruelty of high school. But I think it was more in that spirit that I was thinking, like, oh, I bet people who brought their kids feel really weird right now.
Yeah. High school's rough these days, Rick. High school is rough.
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, I would think high school in real life is way worse than that, you know, because it was when I was in high school. I mean,
because they depicted, like, academic decathlons as even remotely interesting or, like, cool?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah. what a fictitious story this is.
Like, what's an academic? I've never even heard of these things.
Why are all these children that are competing in the academic bowl all very attractive? That doesn't make sense.
It's like secular Bible quizzing, you know? Yeah.
Again, and on a positive note, so Matt, what was your favorite thing about this film, or favorite moment or thing?
Oh man, I mean,
just the start to finish.
Yeah, start to finish, best movie I've thought. You know, I did like, I'm just trying to think of my, Rick, you go first. I have a couple in my head, and I want to narrow it down. So Rick, you take your favorite first.
My favorite thing in this movie was probably just the acting of, if I could take two favorite things, it would be Tom Holland and Michael Keaton, because I think those are the two leads of the movie. And I think that was just my favorite part. I could have watched both of them for a much longer movie and not gotten tired at all. I really enjoyed both of their performances. So overall, that's it for me.
Cool.
Yeah, that was helpful, because I was trying to narrow down to a specific scene, because, of course, things at, like, the Washington Monument were cool, and there were fun action scenes, but I think what I really liked the most, just overall, and there's a lot I liked about it, but I really liked the humor, and I just thought it was a super funny movie. Fizz, you hit on it earlier, when it comes to Lego Batman, it had that kind of funny feel nonstop, and so you had mentioned earlier that fun, sort of the F word of the night, but guess what? Mm-hmm. We had fatherhood. Mm-hmm. We had funny. It's like, what F word's going to be next? I mean, next thing you know, you're going to call this Spider-Man Homecoming and the F word. You get so many hits on this. It'd be amazing.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
That's right.
So let's see. So I would actually point to two scenes that actually were my favorite, and one I've already mentioned, which is technically cheating because it's the Captain America post-credit scene. Because again, I want to give a slow clap, standing ovation to whoever came up with that idea, because it is funny on so many levels to me. But as far as the movie itself goes, I think that because the movie was so the F word the whole time, that when the door opens and Toombs is standing there, I go from like, you know, probably just like Tom Holland or Peter Parker's heart, you know, like from like, this is fun. No, this is exciting. I'm totally in this movie, to like, I shift to the edge of my seat and I say, oh, really? And I am totally hanging on every second after that. Mm-hmm. And that scene in the kitchen, just so many things were going through my head with, you know, Toombs, like with a knife, like cutting things up, and, you know, Peter being super awkward and having no idea what to do. Like, you just see like everything running through his mind. Not able to, like, he literally can't even.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly what he portrayed. And,
oh yeah. I mean, following up on that, the scene where Vulture figures it out, and mm-hmm. Liz leaves the car, and they're talking one-on-one, and, you know, the masks come off, metaphorically, and they're able to talk through. I mean, that scene was amazing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was so good. I mean, you know, and a lot of that, I feel like the credit can be laid at the feet of Michael Keaton. But at the same time, I mean, whether he was just told to look dumbfounded or not, but I think Tom Holland nailed it. Like, I thought he was a deer in headlights, really contemplating his life choices. Like,
yeah,
like, what do I do? You know? So,
hey, you know, let me add one more thing to my funny comment. So, we didn't talk about Karen, the suit that talks to him. I mean, yeah. This is totally original to the film, of course. It's great. Lots of great lines that came out of that whole thing, even when it comes to naming her Karen. Mm-hmm. And the meta thing about it is, I mean, you guys know this, right? That the actress that is the voice is Jennifer Connelly. And in real life, she's married to the voice of Jarvis.
Oh, well, there
which,
you go.
Which is Paul. She's married to Paul Bettany?
Yeah.
Vision?
Yes. Vision is married to Karen.
Well, look what we all learned.
See? Were you guys a fan of Karen?
I thought she was Siri. I didn't know who it was, so let's... Yeah, I don't know.
I'm IMDBing all of this right now.
You're what?
I'm IMDBing all of this right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, were you guys a fan of Karen as a character?
Oh, yeah.
I thought she was fun. Yeah, it was again. Yeah, like you said, completely original to the story. So I was kind of, until he got the suit taken away, I was a little bit grumpy about him having that suit, to be honest, just because I was like, that's not Spider-Man, that's Iron Man. But yeah, she was enjoyable. I can't think of really much about this movie I didn't enjoy, though. I mean, the stuff that I was grumpy about was just because I'm an old comic book nerd. But I get that things need to be adapted for the film and for different audiences, and especially a character as old as Spider-Man is. So I think that was something very relatable too, in the sense that AI is very much in the conversation right now. And just people thinking like, how is that going to affect our lives in the coming day? I thought that was a pretty smart move, actually. So
So we're all big fans, shocker, of something in this film. Well, in the interest of time, like I said, we're kind of wrapping up, but I still wanted to give you guys a chance to mention any last thing. So it could be a recommendation, something that we didn't hit on thematically, or a character kind of like you've already done, Matt, that we just completely skipped over. Any final thoughts?
I'll take it. I like to get people's rankings, and I think you alluded to this earlier, Fizz, but even though I love this, it actually falls, I mean, it's higher for me, so I'm just going to give my ranking for MCU, and then I want to hear you guys' too. So here it is fast. Avengers 1, Guardians 1, Captain America Winter Soldier, Iron Man 1, Guardians 2, Spider-Man. I love all six of those movies. And I don't love Spider-Man as much as the other five I just said. All right, who's up next?
Oh, my goodness. I can't. I don't think I can rank it like that. I can't get my mind on all those. I'll put it up very highly, though. I like this one a lot.
Rick, what's your number one MCU movie?
Probably Avengers, the first Avengers movie. That's probably my favorite of all of them. But the first Iron Man's really good. I don't know. It's hard for me when I get into them. Those are some of my top ones. I liked the only parts I really liked of Civil War was the parts with Spider-Man that I thought were my favorite. I thought if this was like that airport scene at Civil War where all of them together, if that was just the whole movie, that would have been my favorite one. So it's really hard for me to rank the films, but. Yeah, this would be up there, and it's got the fun of like Ant-Man and the comedy and all that too, and I enjoyed that. So, but I feel like the movies are also different too, so it's hard for me to rank them. But let's just say it's up there. I really like it a lot.
Mm. Well, fortunately, we were actually talking about this again before the show. I and many people over at the Real World Theology discussion group have ranked the MCU. Mm-hmm. Now with Spider-Man coming out. And so if you want to go to Letterboxd and see my full MCU ranked list as I feel about them right this moment, which means that they could probably shift, because things kind of tend to be in a couple tiers there. My favorite movie in the MCU is still Avengers. I still think it is basically a near-perfect movie. Because I think you can watch it and not have to watch anything that came before it. Joss Whedon does a great job. And right now, I have Spider-Man as my number two, my two film. But to be fair, ranking-wise, it's basically tied with Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one, and Captain America, the first Avenger, which I love more than apparently almost anybody else on the planet. And the first Iron Man movie. I think that would be my top five. I think numbers 2 through 5 for me are all probably whichever one I watched last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel weird putting Spider-Man 6 because I love it, but I just mm-hmm. love all six of those movies.
Yeah, it's tough. So I think I went and did this list, and then I went back and looked at the star ratings I gave to all these films, and I did put them basically in the order that I had given them star ratings. So, again, interchangeably. So, like, numbers, you know, 2 through 5 for me are all, like, 4.5 star rated movies. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all the films that I thought were near perfect. And then, again, you get, like, into the ones after it. Like they're all like the next 4 or 5 movies are movies that I all rank like 4 stars. And then there's the ones that I rank like 3.5. And then, you know, so there, like I said, that I feel like my Marvel list is more of a tiered ranking than it is like a specific, this film than this film, outside of Avengers being my number one. So that would be my very long winded way to answer that film.
Nice. I like it. I'm looking at your list on the box right now.
I am too. I'm on the same page.
I'm glad you were all listening intently to what I was actually saying then.
I'll hear it on the podcast.
Yeah, I'll just listen later. So, Rick, any final thoughts that you have?
No, I just it's so nice to have like a fun movie though. I mean that's my final thought. I think DC could learn a lot from these recent Marvel ones. And I hope that we'll see like a tonal shift in some of those things. I just think we're tired of origin stories, for one thing, for characters that we've seen a thousand times. Mm-hmm. And it was just nice to have a movie that you just left feeling good about, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't always feel that way about movies, and I don't think all movies have to be that, but for Spider-Man, I mean, that kind of is something you want, and I feel like they just got the tone really well on this one. So I'm enough of a fan of movies to just say, yeah, it doesn't have to be straight like the comic book for it to be a really good, enjoyable movie by itself. And I enjoyed it almost more than any of the Marvel movies I can think of. So yeah. Good on you, Marvel and Sony. Well done. Yeah.
Well, I'll say two things to that. The first is, I think DC, based on news that has kind of like matriculated out after Wonder Woman, I think they've learned a lot of lessons from Wonder Woman, which mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily learn those lessons from Marvel, because I think they were doing their own thing. But I think lots of those lessons kind of cross-pollinate themselves. The other is, Rick, I'm really glad that I could have you back on an episode for Spider-Man that wasn't probably... arguably the worst Spider-Man that had been made. So,
that's right.
The worst and the best. You were the alpha and omega of Spider-Man podcast.
Wow. That's awesome. That's right. Yeah, well, my pleasure to be back.
Well, with that, like I feel like I say every episode, great conversations have because we have great guests, and I've really enjoyed this. We, you know, admit that this podcast is full of the F word, fun. So it was cool that this movie was mostly just a movie that we could sit back, really immerse ourselves in, and enjoy. There's obviously in everything, whether, you know, like I said, we're not trying to Jesus juke anybody. We're not trying to put something there that's unintentional. But every movie makes us kind of reflect upon things. And this one definitely had some cool fatherhood stuff there. So that was fun to talk about as well. And I'm really glad that you guys, who I don't get to have on the show very often, were able to make some time for this. So I want to make sure that everyone who's listening has a chance to connect with the guy, with you and the work and the things that you're doing. So Matt, how can people follow you on the internet and follow the things that you do?
Yeah, you can find me at a podcast called The Sci-Fi Christian, which is at thesci-fi-christian.com.
Awesome. So, Rick, how can people follow all the things that you're involved in?
Oh, man, there's a lot. Just look up Rick Lee James. That's my name on Twitter. You can go to facebook.com/Rick Lee James. I have a website, rickleejames.com, and I have a podcast called Voices in My Head. And just look up my name, Voices in My Head. You'll find it. I pretty much guarantee, as long as you use Rick Lee James, L-E-E, and not just Rick James. If you just put in Rick James, you'll get the guy that sang Super Freak. But yeah, that's the best way to find me online. And Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. I'm on just about every platform, I think.
Well, it sounds like no matter how they put in your name, it sounds like win-win. So.
Yeah, that's right. Win-win, either way.
Oh, well, I'll make sure to have all those links in the show notes for both our great guests. So make sure you check there at realworldtheology.com. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. If you'd like to support the show, which I hope you do, you can do so by either downloading the show from iTunes or your podcast caster of choice. Leave us some reviews. That helps us more than we can explain. Go to realworldtheology.com/support, and you can see some very specific ways that you can support us. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm looking forward because we, as we mentioned at the very first of the podcast, 2017 has been a pretty great year for film. And we have so many great episodes that I know are coming up that it's just churning them out one after the other. I hope everyone else is enjoying these conversations as much as we're actually enjoying the films themselves. But for the meantime, for Real World Theology, again, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
But again, yeah. Again, not that it's a competition, but Matt is winning.
Matt is winning. So,
Matt, do Sorry, you just have like, the worst internet ever? What is going on?
What happened to your internet? Oh. Are you back, Matt?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
You sound like you were getting better. Yeah, I mean, we can hear you. Like I said, the problem isn't that we can't hear you. It's just, it just sounds awful. It's like... that's what it sounds like. So, like, and we talk, and it doesn't sound like you're getting like anything that we're saying until much later.
I don't know what to do. Should I try to...
You sound fine right this second, I believe.
All right, I'll do it really quick, right?
All right, so you did that. I got everything, except I'm pretty sure you were going to tell a funny little quip about how this is the only place where you give out your Twitter account.
Yes, I'm so funny. No, okay, should we skip that part? I'll start saying it, and then do you want to just edit it wherever you need to?
Yeah, you just give me all the pieces, and I'll make it work somehow.
All right, I trust you. My... Barely ever. In fact, I think your podcast is the only place that I
handle Sorry.
Because it's the lamest you can imagine.
It's like only when he starts talking
it is.
For the recording that it starts messing up. All the rest of the time, it's fine. It's I'm sorry to laugh. It's just so funny.
I don't know what to tell you. It sounds. You guys sound so good.
I know. It's like, true. I sound amazing.
It's like God doesn't want you to say it. It's like every time you start talking,
even God is embarrassed of your Twitter handle.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's fine. Whatever.
Just edit it out. Because I said the podcast website, and then there was a little bit of pause on my end, and you could just be like, "All right, Rick, on to you."
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. I've got it.